of every leaf magnified in the darkness, until Robin and Barclay lowered themselves back into the dell and began to dig again. Robin's muscles were now begging for mercy, her palms beginning to blister beneath the gloves. The deeper they dug, the harder the job became, the soil compacted and full of rocks. Barclay's end of the trench was considerably deeper than Robin's.
"Let me do a bit," Strike suggested.
"No," she snapped, too tired to be anything but blunt. "You'll boogie your leg completely."
"She's near wrong, pal," panted Barclay. "Gish another drink of water, I'm gasping."
An hour later, Barclay was standing waist-deep in soil, and Robin's palms were bleeding beneath the overlarge gloves, which were rubbing away layers of skin as she used the blunt end of the mattock to try and prise a heavy rock out of the ground.
"Come on, you bloody thing!"
"Want a hand?" offered Strike, readying himself to descend. "Stay there," she told him angrily. "I'm not going to be able to help carry you back to the car. Not after this." A final involuntary yelp escaped her as she succeeded in overturning the small boulder. A couple of tiny, wriggling insects attached to the underside slid away from the torchlight. Strike directed the beam back on Barclay.
"Cormoran," said Robin sharply.
"What?"
"I need light." Something in her voice made Barclay stop digging. Rather than direct the beam back at her and disregarding her warning of a moment ago, Strike slid back down into the pit, landing on the loose earth. The torchlight swung around, blinding Robin for a second.
"What have you seen?"
"Shine it here," she said, "on the rock." Barclay clambered towards them, his jeans covered from hem to pockets in soil. Strike did as Robin asked. The three of them peered down at the encrusted surface of the rock. There, stuck to the mud, was a strand of what was plainly not vegetable matter, but wool fibers, faintly but distinctly pink. They turned in unison to examine the indentation left in the ground where the rock had sat, Strike directing the torchlight into the hole.
"Oh, shit!" gasped Robin,
and without thinking, she clapped two muddy garden gloves to her face. A couple of inches of filthy material had been revealed, and in the strong beam of the torch, it too was pink.
"Give me that," said Strike,
tugging the mattock out of her hand.
"No."
But he almost pushed her aside. By the deflected torchlight, she could see his expression, forbidding, furious, as though the pink blanket had grievously wronged him, as though he had suffered a personal affront.
"Barclay, you take this."
He thrust the mattock at his subcontractor.
"Break this up as much as you can.
Try not to puncture the blanket. Robin, go to the other end. Use the fork.
And mind my hands," Strike told Barclay.
Sticking the torch in his mouth so that he could see by its light, he fell to his knees in the dirt and began to move earth aside with his fingers.
"Listen," whispered Robin, freezing.
The sound of the terrier's frenzied barking reached them once again through the night air.
"I yelled, didn't I, when I overturned the rock?" whispered Robin. "I think I woke it up again."
"Never mind that now," said Strike,
his fingers prising dirt away from the blanket.
"Dig."
"But what if—"
"We'll deal with that if it happens. Dig."
Robin plied the fork. After a couple of minutes, Barclay swapped the mattock for a shovel. Slowly, the length of the pink blanket, its content still buried too deep to remove, was revealed.
"That's no adult," said Barclay,
surveying the stretch of filthy blanket. And still, the terrier continued to yap, distantly from the direction of Chisel House.
"We should call the police, Strike," said Barclay,
pausing to wipe sweat and mud out of his eyes.
"Are we no disturbing a crime scene here?"
Strike didn't answer. Feeling slightly sick, Robin watched his fingers feeling the shape of the thing that was hidden beneath the filthy blanket.
"Go up to my kit bag," he told her. "There's a knife in there, Stanley knife. Quickly."
The terrier was still yapping distractedly. Robin thought it sounded louder. She clambered up the steep side of the dell, groped around in the dark depths of the bag, found the knife, and slid back down to strike.
"Cormoran, I think Sam's right," she whispered. "We should leave this to the..."
"Give me the knife," he said, holding out his hand. "Come on, quick, I can feel it. This is the skull. Quickly."
Against her better instincts, she handed over the blade. There was a sound of puncturing fabric, and then a ripping.
"What are you doing?"
she gasped, watching Strike tugging at something in the ground.
"Jesus fuck, Strike," said Barclay angrily. "Are you trying to rip off its..."
With a dreadful crunching noise, the earth gave up something large and white. Robin gave a small yelp, stepped backwards and fell, half-sitting, into the wall of the dell.
"Fuck," repeated Barclay.
Strike shifted the torch to his free hand, so as to shine it onto the thing he had just dragged out of the earth. Stunned, Robin and Barclay saw the discolored and partially shattered skull of a horse. Chapter 66. Do not sit here musing and brooding over insoluble conundrums. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Protected through the years by the blanket, the skull shone pale in the torchlight, weirdly reptilian in the length of its nose and the sharpness of its mandibles. A few blunt teeth remained. There were cavities in the skull in addition to the eye holes, one in the jaw, one to the side of the head, and around each the bone was cracked and splintered.
"Shot," said Strike, turning the skull slowly in his hands.
A third indentation showed the course of another bullet, which had fractured but not penetrated the horse's head. Robin knew she would have been feeling far worse had the skull been human, but she was nonetheless shaken by the noise it had made when released from the earth, and by the unexpected sight of this fragile shell of what had once lived and breathed, stripped bare by bacteria and insects. "Vets euthanize horses with a single shot to the forehead," she said. "They don't spray them with bullets."
"Rifle," said Barclay authoritatively, clambering nearer to examine the skull. "Someone's took port shots at it." "Not that big, is it? Was it a foal?"
Strike asked Robin.
"Maybe, but I think it looks more like a pony or a miniature horse."
He turned it slowly in his hands, and all three of them watched the skull moving in the torchlight. They had expended so much pain and effort digging it out of the ground that it seemed to hold secrets beyond those of its mere existence.
"So, Billy did witness a burial," said Strike.
"But it wasn't a child."
"You won't have to rethink your theory," said Robin.
"Theory," repeated Barclay, and was ignored. "I don't know, Robin," said Strike, his face ghostly beyond the torchlight. "If he didn't invent the burial, I don't think he invented." "Shite," said Barclay. "She's done it. She's let those fucking dogs out."
The yapping of the terrier and the deeper, booming barks of the Labrador, no longer muffled by containing walls, came ringing through the night. Without ceremony, Strike dropped the skull.
"Barclay, grab all the tools and get out of here. We'll hold the dogs off."
"What about—"
"Leave it. There is no time to fill it in," said Strike, already clambering out of the dell, ignoring the excruciating pain in the end of his stump. "Robin, come on, you're with me."
"What if she's called the police?"
Robin said, reaching the top of the dell first and turning to help heave Strike up.
"We'll wing it," he panted. "Come on, I want to stop the dogs before they get to Sam."
The woods were dense and tangled. Strike had left his walking stick behind. Robin held his arm as he limped as fast as he could, grunting with pain every time he asked his stump to bear his weight. Robin glimpsed a pinprick of light through the trees. Somebody had come out of the house with a torch. Suddenly, the Norfolk Terrier burst through the undergrowth, barking ferociously.
"Good boy, yes, you found us,"
Robin panted. Ignoring her friendly overture, it launched itself at her, trying to bite. She kicked out at it with her Wellingtoned foot, holding it at bay while sounds reached them of the heavier Labrador crashing towards them.
"Little fucker," said Strike,
trying to repel the Norfolk Terrier as it darted around them, snarling. But seconds later, the terrier had caught wind of Barclay.
It turned its head towards the dell, and before either of them could stop it, took off again, yapping frenziedly.
Shit, said Robin. Never mind, keep going, said Strike, though the end of his stump was burning, and he wondered how much longer it would support him.
They had managed only a few more paces when the fat Labrador reached them.
Good boy, yes, good boy, Robin crooned.
And the Labrador, less enthusiastic about the chase, allowed her to secure a tight grip on its collar.
Come on, come with us, said Robin.
And she half-dragged it, with Strike still leaning on her, towards the overgrown croquet lawn, where they now saw a torch bobbing ever nearer through the darkness. A shrill voice called,
Badger! Rattenbury!
Who's that? Who's there?
The silhouette behind the torchlight was female and bulky.
It's all right, Mrs. Chiswell, called Robin. It's only us.
Who's us? Who are you?
Follow my lead, Strike muttered to Robin, and he called,
Mrs. Chiswell, it's Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott.
What are you doing here?
She shouted, across the diminishing space between them.
We were interviewing Tegan Butcher in the village, Mrs. Chiswell, called Strike,
as he, Robin, and the reluctant Badger made their laborious way through the long grass.
We were driving back this way and we saw two people entering your property.
What two people? Where?
They entered the woods back there, said Strike.
From the depths of the trees, the Norfolk Terrier was still frenziedly barking.
We didn't have your number or we'd have called to warn you.
Within a few feet of her now, they saw that Kinvara was wearing a thick padded coat over a short nightdress of black silk, her legs bare above Wellington boots. Her suspicion, shock, and incredulity met Strike's total assurance.
"Thought we ought to do something, seeing as we were the only people who witnessed it," he gasped, wincing a little as he hobbled up to her with Robin's assistance, self-deprecatingly heroic. "Apologies," he added, coming to a halt, "for the state of us. Those woods are muddy, and I fell over a couple of times."
A cold breeze swept the dark lawn. Kinvara stared at him, flummoxed, suspicious, then turned her face in the direction of the terrier's continued barking.
"Rattenbury!" she shouted. "Rattenbury!"
She turned back to Strike.
"What did they look like?"
"Men," invented Strike. "Young and fit from the way they were moving. We knew you'd had trouble with trespassers before."
"Yes, yes, I have," said Kinvara,
sounding frightened. She seemed to take in Strike's condition for the first time, as he leaned heavily on Robin, face contorted with pain.
"I suppose you'd better come in."
"Thanks very much," said Strike gratefully. "Very kind of you."
Kinvara jerked the Labrador's collar out of Robin's grip and bellowed,
"Rattenbury!"
again. But the distantly barking terrier did not respond, so she dragged the Labrador, which was showing signs of rebellion, back towards the house, Robin and Strike following.
"What if she calls the police?"
Robin muttered to Strike.
"Cross that bridge when we come to it," he responded.
A floor-to-ceiling drawing-room window stood open. Kinvara had evidently followed her frantic dogs through it as the quickest route to the woods.
"We're pretty muddy,"
Robin warned her, as they crunched their way across the gravel path that encircled the house.
"Just leave your boots outside,"
said Kinvara, stepping into the drawing room without bothering to remove her own.
"I'm planning to change this carpet anyway."
Robin tugged off her wellies, followed Strike inside, and closed the window. The cold, dingy room was illuminated by a single lamp.
"Two men,"
Kinvara repeated, turning again to Strike.
"Where exactly did you see them coming in?"
"Over the wall at the road," said Strike.
"Do you think they knew you'd seen them?"
"Oh, yeah," said Strike. "We pulled up, but they ran into the woods. Think they might have bottled it once we followed them, though, don't you?" he asked Robin.
"Yes," said Robin.
"We think we heard them running back towards the road when you let the dogs out."
"Rattenbury's still chasing someone. Of course, that could be a fox. He goes crazy about foxes in the woods,"
said Kinvara. Strike's attention had just been caught by a change to the room since the last time he had seen it. There was a fresh square of dark crimson wallpaper over the mantelpiece, where the painting of the mare and foal had hung.
"What happened to your picture?" he asked.
Kinvara turned to see what Strike was talking about. She answered, perhaps a few seconds too late.
"I sold it."
"Oh," said Strike. "I thought you were particularly fond of that one."
"Not since what Torkoal said that day. I didn't like having it hanging there after that."
"Ah," said Strike. Rattenbury's persistent barking continued to echo from the woods, where, Strike was certain, it had found Barclay struggling back to his car with two kit bags full of tools. Now that Kinvara had released her hold on its collar, the fat Labrador let out a single booming bark and trotted to the window, where it began whining and pawing at the glass.
"The police won't get here in time if I call them," said Kinvara, half worried, half angry. "I'm never top priority. They think I make it all up, these intruders." "I'm going to check on the horses," she said, coming to a decision.
But instead of going out through the window, she stomped out of the drawing room into the hall, and from there, as far as they could hear, into a different room.
"I hope the dog hasn't got Barclay," Robin whispered.
"Better hope he hasn't brained it with a spade," muttered Strike.
The door reopened. Kinvara had returned, and to Robin's consternation, she was carrying a revolver.
"I'll take that," said Strike, hobbling forwards and taking the revolver out of her startled grip. He examined it. "Harrington and Richardson 7-shot. This is illegal, Mrs. Chiswell."
"It was Jasper's," she replied,
as though this constituted a special permit.
"And I'd rather take—"
"I'll come with you to check on the horses," said Strike firmly. "And Robin can stay here and keep an eye on the house."
Kinvara might have liked to protest, but Strike was already opening the drawing-room window. Seizing its opportunity, the Labrador lumbered back out into the dark garden, its deep barks echoing around the grounds.
"Oh, for God's sake! You shouldn't have let him out! Badger!" shouted Kinvara.
She whipped back around to Robin, said, "Mind you stay in this room," then followed the Labrador back into the garden, Strike limping after her with the rifle. Both disappeared into the darkness. Robin stood where they had left her, struck by the vehemence of Kinvara's order. The open window had admitted plenty of night air into what was already a chilly interior. Robin approached the log basket beside the fire, which was temptingly full of newspaper, sticks, logs and firelighters, but she could hardly build a fire in Kinvara's absence. The room was as shabby in every respect as she remembered it, the walls now denuded of everything but four prints of Oxfordshire landscapes. Outside in the grounds, the two dogs continued to bark, but inside the room the only sound, which Robin hadn't noticed on her last visit, due to the family's talking and bickering, was the loud ticking of an old grandfather clock in the corner. Every muscle in Robin's body was starting to ache after the long hours of digging, and her blistered hands were smarting. She had just sat down on the sagging sofa, hugging herself for warmth, when she heard a creak overhead that sounded very like a footstep. Robin stared up at the ceiling. She had probably imagined it. Old houses made strange noises that sounded human until they were familiar to you. Her parents' radiators made chugging noises in the night, and their old doors groaned in the central heating. It was probably nothing. A second creak sounded, several feet from where the first had occurred. As she got to her feet, Robin scanned the room for anything she could use as a weapon. A small, ugly bronze frog ornament sat on a table beside the sofa. As her fingers closed over the cold pockmarked surface, she heard a third creak from overhead. Unless she was imagining it, the footsteps had now moved all the way across a room, directly above the one in which she was. Robin stood quite still for almost a minute, straining her ears. She knew what Strike would say. Stay put. Then she heard another tiny movement overhead. Somebody, she was sure, was creeping around upstairs. Moving as quietly as possible in her socked feet, Robin edged around the drawing room door without touching it, in case it creaked, and walked quietly into the middle of the stone-flagged hall, where the hanging lantern cast a patchy light. She came to a halt beneath it, straining her ears, heart bumping erratically, imagining an unknown person standing above her, also standing, frozen, listening, waiting. Bronze Frog still clutched in her right hand. She moved to the foot of the stairs. The landing above her was in darkness. The sound of the dogs barking echoed from deep in the woods. She was halfway towards the upper landing when she thought she heard another small noise above her. The scuff of a foot on carpet, followed by the swish of a closing door. She knew that there was no point calling out, "Who's there?" If the person hiding from her had been prepared to show their face, they would hardly have let Kinvara leave the house alone to face whatever had set off the dogs. Reaching the top of the stairs, Robin saw that a vertical strip of light lay like a spectral figure across the dark floor, emanating from the only lit room. Her neck and scalp prickled as she crept towards it, afraid that the unknown lurker was watching from one of the three dark rooms with open doors she was passing. Constantly checking over her shoulder, she pushed the door of the lit bedroom with the tips of her fingers, raised the bronze frog high, and entered. This was clearly Kinvara's room, messy, cluttered, and deserted. A single lamp burned on the bedside table nearest the door. The bed was unmade, with an air of having been left in a hurry, the cream-quilted eiderdown lying crumpled on the floor. The walls were covered with many pictures of horses, all of them of significantly lesser quality, even to Robin's untutored eye, than the missing picture in the drawing room. The wardrobe doors stood open, but only a Lilliputian could have been hidden among the densely packed clothes within. Robin returned to the dark landing. Taking a tighter grip on the bronze frog, she orientated herself. The sounds she had heard had come from a room directly overhead, which meant that it was probably the one with the closed door, facing her. As she reached out a hand towards the doorknob, the terrifying sensation that unseen eyes were watching intensified. Pushing the door open, she felt around on the interior wall without entering, until she found a light switch. The stark light revealed a cold, bare bedroom with a brass bedstead and a single chest of drawers. The heavy curtains on their old-fashioned brass rings had been drawn, hiding the grounds. On the double bed lay the painting Mare Mourning, the brown and white mare forever nosing the pure white foal, curled up in the straw. Groping in the pocket of her jacket, with the hand not holding the bronze paperweight, Robin found her mobile and took several photographs of the painting lying on the bedspread. It had the appearance of having been hastily placed there. She had a sudden feeling that something had moved behind her. She whipped around, trying to blink away the shining impression of the gilded frame burned into her retina by the flash on her camera. Then she heard Strikes and Kinvara's voices growing louder in the garden and knew that they were returning to the drawing room. Slapping off the light in the spare room, Robin ran as quietly as possible back across the landing and down the stairs. Fearing that she wouldn't be able to reach the drawing room in time to greet them, she darted to the downstairs bathroom, flushed the toilet, and then ran back across the hall, reaching the drawing room just as her hostess re-entered it from the garden. Chapter 67. I had good reason enough for so jealously drawing a veil of concealment over our compact. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. The Norfolk Terrier was struggling in Kinvara's arms, its paws muddy. At the sight of Robin, Rattenbury set up a volley of barking again and struggled to get free. "Sorry, I was dying for the loo," panted Robin, the bronze frog hidden behind her back. The old cistern backed up her story, making loud gushing and clanking noises that echoed through the stone-flagged hallway. "Any luck?" Robin called to Strike, who was climbing back into the room behind Kinvara.
"Nothing," said Strike, now haggard with pain.
After waiting for the panting Labrador to hop back into the room, he closed the window, the revolver in his other hand.
"There were definitely people out there, though. The dogs knew it, but I think they've taken off. What were the odds of us passing just as they were climbing over the wall?"
"Oh, do shut up, Rattenbury!"
shouted Kinvara. She set the terrier down, and when it refused to stop yapping at Robin, she threatened it with a raised hand,
at which it whimpered and retreated into a corner to join the Labrador. "Horse is okay?" Robin asked, moving to the end table from which he had taken the bronze paperweight.
"One of the stable doors wasn't fastened properly," said Strike, wincing as he bent to feel his knee. "But Mrs. Chisel thinks it might have been left like that. Would you mind if I sat down, Mrs. Chisel?"
No, I suppose not,"
Kinvara said gracelessly. She headed to a table of bottles sitting in the corner of the room, uncorked some famous grouse, and poured herself a stiff measure of whiskey. While her back was turned, Robin slid the paperweight back onto the table. She tried to catch Strike's eye, but he had sunk down onto the sofa with a faint groan, and now turned to Kinvara.
"I wouldn't say no if you're offering," he said shamelessly, wincing again as he massaged his right knee. "Actually, I think this is going to have to come off. Do you mind?"
"Well, no, I suppose not. What do you want?"
"I'll have a scotch as well, please," said Strike, setting the revolver down on the table beside the bronze frog, rolling up his trouser leg, and signalling with his eyes that Robin, too, should sit down.
While Kinvara sloshed another measure into a glass, Strike started to remove the prosthesis. Turning to give him his drink, Kinvara watched in queasy fascination as Strike worked on the false leg, averting her eyes at the point it left the inflamed stump. Panting as he propped the prosthesis against the ottoman, Strike allowed his trouser leg to fall back over his amputated leg.
"Thanks very much," he said,
accepting the whiskey from her and taking a swig. Trapped with a man who couldn't walk, to whom she ought in theory to be grateful, and to whom she had just given a drink, Kinvara sat down too, her expression stony.
"Actually, Mrs. Chisel, I was going to phone you to confirm a couple of things we heard from Tegan earlier," said Strike. "We could go through them now, if you like. Get them out of the way."
With a slight shiver, Kinvara glanced at the empty fireplace, and Robin said helpfully,
"Would you like me to—"
"No,"
snapped Kinvara.
"I can do it."
She went to the deep basket standing beside the fireplace, from which she grabbed an old newspaper. While Kinvara built a structure of small bits of wood over a mound of newspaper and a firelighter, Robin succeeded in catching Strike's eye.
"There's somebody upstairs,"
she mouthed, but she wasn't sure he had understood. He merely raised his eyebrows quizzically and turned back to Kinvara. A match flared. Flames erupted around the little pile of paper and sticks in the fireplace. Kinvara picked up her glass and returned to the drinks table, where she topped it up with more neat scotch. Then, coat wrapped more tightly around herself, she returned to the log basket, selected a large piece of wood, dropped it on top of the burgeoning fire, then fell back onto the sofa.
"Go on, then," she said sullenly to Strike. "What do you want to know?"
"As I say, we spoke to Tegan Butcher today."
"And?"
"And we now know what Jimmy Knight and Geraint Wynne were blackmailing your husband about."
Kinvara evinced no surprise.
"I told those stupid girls you find out," she said with a shrug, "Izzy and Fizzy. Everyone round here knew what Jack O'Kent was doing in the barn. Of course somebody was going to talk."
She took a gulp of whiskey.
"I suppose you know all of it, do you? The gallows? The boy in Zimbabwe?"
"You mean Samuel?" asked Strike, taking a punt.
"Exactly. Samuel Mudrap or something."
The fire caught suddenly, flames leaping up past the log, which shifted in a shower of sparks.
"Jasper was worried they were his gallows the moment we heard the boy had been hanged. You know all of it, do you? That there were two sets, but only one made it to the government. The other lot went astray. The lorry was hijacked or something. That's how they ended up in the middle of nowhere. The photographs are pretty grisly, apparently. The Foreign Office thinks it was probably a case of mistaken identity. Jasper didn't see how they could be traced to him, but Jimmy said he could prove they were." "I knew you'd find out," said Kinvara, with an air of bitter satisfaction. "Tegan's a horrible gossip."
"So to be clear," said Strike, "when Jimmy Knight first came here to see you, he was asking for his and Billy's share for two sets of gallows his father had left completed when he died."
"Exactly,"
said Kinvara, sipping her whisky. They were worth 80,000 for the pair. He wanted 40.
But presumably, said Strike, who remembered that Chisel had talked of Jimmy returning a week after his first attempt to get money and asking for a reduced amount, your husband told him he'd only ever receive payment for one of them, as one set got stolen en route.
Yes, said Kinvara with a shrug. So then Jimmy asked for 20, but we'd spent it.
How did you feel about Jimmy's request when he first came asking for money? Strike asked. Robin wasn't sure whether Kinvara had turned a little pinker in the face, or whether it was the effects of the whiskey.
Well, I saw his point, if you want the truth. I could see why he felt he had a claim. Half the proceeds of the gallows belonged to the Night Boys. That had been the arrangement while Jacko Kent was alive. But Jasper took the view that Jimmy couldn't expect money for the stolen set, and given that he'd been storing them in his barn and bearing all the costs of transportation and so on, and he said that Jimmy couldn't sue him even if he wanted to. He didn't like Jimmy.
No, well, I suppose their politics were very different, said Strike. Kinvara almost smirked.
It was a bit more personal than that. Haven't you heard about Jimmy and Izzy? No, I suppose Tegan's too young to have heard that story. Oh, it was only once, she said, apparently under the impression that Strike was shocked. But that was quite enough for Jasper. A man like Jimmy Knight deflowering his darling daughter, you know. But Jasper couldn't have given Jimmy the money even if he'd wanted to, she went on. He'd already spent it. It took care of our overdraft for a while and repaired the stable roof. I never knew, she added, as though sensing unspoken criticism, until Jimmy explained it to me that night, what the arrangement between Jasper and Jacko Kent had been. Jasper had told me the gallows were his to sell, and I believed him. Naturally, I believed him. He was my husband.
She got up again and headed back to the drinks table, as the fat Labrador, seeking warmth, left its distant corner, waddled around the ottoman, and slumped down in front of the now roaring fire. The Norfolk Terrier trotted after it, growling at Strike and Robin, until Kinvara said angrily,
"Shut up, Rattenbury!"
"There's a couple more things I wanted to ask you about," said Strike. "Firstly, did your husband have a passcode on his phone?"
"Of course he did," said Kinvara. "He was very security conscious."
"So he didn't give it out to a lot of people?"
"He didn't even tell me what it was," said Kinvara. "Why are you asking?"
Ignoring the question, Strike said, "Your stepson's now told us a different story to account for his trip down here, on the morning of your husband's death."
"Oh, really? What's he saying this time?"
"That he was trying to stop you selling a necklace that's been in the family for..."
"Come clean, has he?"
she interrupted, turning back towards them with a fresh whiskey in her hands. With her long red hair tangled from the night air and her flushed cheeks, she had a slight air of abandon now, forgetting to hold her coat closed as she headed back to the sofa, the black nightdress revealing a canyon of cleavage. She flopped back down on the sofa.
"Yes, he wanted to stop me doing a flit with the necklace, which, by the way, I'm perfectly entitled to do. It's mine under the terms of the will. Jasper should have been a bit more bloody careful writing it if he didn't want me to have it, shouldn't he?"
Robin remembered Kinbara's tears, the last time they had been in this room, and how she had felt sorry for her, unlikable though she had shown herself to be in other ways. Her attitude now had little of the grief-stricken widow about it, but perhaps, Robin thought, that was the drink, and the recent shock of their intrusion into her grounds. "So you're backing up Raphael's story that he drove down here to stop you taking off with the necklace?"
"Don't you believe him?"
"Not really," said Strike. "No."
"Why not?"
"It rings false," said Strike. "I'm not convinced your husband was in a fit state that morning to remember what he had and hadn't put in his will."
"He was well enough to call me and demand to know whether I was really walking out on him," said Kinvara.
"Did you tell him you were going to sell the necklace?"
"Not in so many words, no. I said I was going to leave as soon as I could find somewhere else for me and the horses. I suppose he might have wondered how I'd manage that, with no real money of my own, which made him remember the necklace."
"So Raphael came here out of simple loyalty to the father, who cut him off without a penny?"
Kinvara subjected Strike to a long and penetrating look over her whiskey glass, then said to Robin,
"Would you throw another log on the fire?"
Noting the lack of a please, Robin nevertheless did as she was asked. The Norfolk Terrier, which had now joined the sleeping Labrador on the hearthrug, growled at her until she had sat down again.
"All right," said Kinvara, with an air of coming to a decision. "All right, here it is. I don't suppose it matters any more anyway. Those bloody girls will find out in the end and serve Raphael right." "He did come down to try and stop me taking the necklace, but it wasn't for Jasper, Fizzy, or Flops's sake. I suppose," she said aggressively to Robin, "you know all the family nicknames, don't you? You probably had a good giggle at them while you were working with Izzy." "Oh, don't pretend," said Kinvara rather nastily. "I know you'll have heard them. They call me Tinky too or something, don't they? And behind his back, Izzy, Fizzy and Torquil call Raphael Rancid. Did you know that?"
"No," said Robin, at whom Kinvara was still glaring.
"Sweet, isn't it? And Raphael's mother is known to all of them as the Orca, because she dresses in black and white. Anyway, when the Orca realized Jasper wasn't going to marry her," said Kinvara, now very red in the face, "do you know what she did?"
Robin shook her head.
"She took the famous family necklace to the man who became her next lover, who was a diamond merchant, and she had him prize out the really valuable stones and replace them with cubic zirconias. Man-made diamond substitutes," Kinvara elucidated, in case Strike and Robin hadn't understood. "Jasper never realized what she'd done, and I certainly didn't. I expect Ornella's been having a jolly good laugh every time I've been photographed in the necklace, thinking I'm wearing £100,000 worth of stones. Anyway, when my darling stepson got wind of the fact that I was leaving his father, and heard that I talked about having enough money to buy land for the horses, he twigged that I might be about to get the necklace valued. So he came hot-footing it down here, because the last thing he wanted was for the family to find out what his mother had done. What would be the odds of him wheedling his way back into his father's good books after that?"
"Why haven't you told anyone this?" asked Strike.
"Because Raphael promised me that morning that if I didn't tell his father what the Orca had done, he'd maybe manage to persuade his mother to give the stones back. Or at least give me their value."
"And are you still trying to recover the missing stones?"
Kinvara squinted malevolently at Strike over the rim of her glass.
"I haven't done anything about it since Jasper died, but that doesn't mean I won't. Why should I let the bloody Orca waltz off with what's rightfully mine? It's down in Jasper's will, the contents of the house that haven't been specifically excluded,"
she enunciated carefully, thick-tongued now,
"belong to me. So,"
she said, fixing Strike with a gimlet stare,
"does that sound more like Raphael to you? Coming down here to try and cover up for his darling mama?"
"Yes," said Strike. "I'd have to say it does. Thank you for your honesty."
Kinvara looked pointedly at the grandfather clock, which was now showing 3 in the morning, but Strike refused to take the hint.
"Mrs. Chisel, there's one last thing I want to ask, and I'm afraid it's quite personal."
"What?"
she said crossly.
"I spoke to Mrs. Wynne recently. Della Wynne, you know, the..."
"Della Wynne, the Minister for Sport,"
said Kinvara, just as her husband had done the first time Strike met him.
"Yes, I know who she is. Very odd woman."
"In what way?"
Kinvara wriggled her shoulders impatiently, as though it should be obvious.
"Never mind. What did she say?"
"That she met you in a state of considerable distress a year ago, and that, from what she could gather, you were upset because your husband had admitted to an affair."
Kinvara opened her mouth and then closed it again. She sat thus for a few seconds, then shook her head as though to clear it, and said,
"I thought he was being unfaithful, but I was wrong. I got it all wrong."
"According to Mrs. Wynne, he'd said some fairly cruel things to you."
"I don't remember what I said to her. I wasn't very well at the time.
I was over-emotional, and I got everything wrong.
Forgive me, said Strike, but as an outsider, your marriage seemed...
What a dreadful job you've got, said Kinvara shrilly. What a really nasty, seedy job you do. Yes, our marriage was going wrong. What of it? Do you think now he's dead, now he's killed himself, I want to relive it all with a pair of you? Perfect strangers whom my stupid stepdaughters have dragged in to stir everything up and make it 10 times worse.
So you've changed your mind, have you? You think your husband committed suicide? Because when we were last here, you suggested Amir Malik.
I don't know what I said then, she said hysterically. Can you not understand what it's been like since Jasper killed himself, with the police and the family and you? I didn't think this would happen. I had no idea. It didn't seem real. Jasper was under enormous pressure these last few months, drinking too much, in an awful temper. The blackmail, the fear of it all coming out. Yes, I think he killed himself. And I've got to live with the fact that I walked out on him that morning, which was probably the final straw.
The Norfolk Terrier began to yap furiously again. The Labrador woke with a start and started barking too.
Please leave, shouted Kinvara, getting to her feet. Get out! I never wanted you mixed up in this in the first place. Just go, will you?
Certainly, said Strike politely, setting down his empty glass. Would you mind waiting while I get my leg back on? Robin had already stood up. Strike strapped the false leg back on while Kinvara watched, chest heaving, glass in hand. At last, Strike was ready to stand, but his first attempt had him falling back onto the sofa. With Robin's assistance, he finally achieved a standing position.
Well, goodbye, Mrs. Chisel.
Kinvara's only answer was to stalk to the window and fling it open again, shouting at the dogs, which had got up excitedly, to stay put. No sooner had her unwelcome guests stepped out onto the gravel path than Kinvara slammed the window behind them. While Robin put her Wellington boots back on, they heard the shriek of the brass curtain rings as Kinvara dragged the drape shut, then called the dogs out of the room.
"Not sure I'm going to be able to make it back to the car, Robin," said Strike, who wasn't putting weight on his prosthesis. "In retrospect, the digging might have been a mistake."
Wordlessly, Robin took his arm and placed it over her shoulders. He didn't resist. Together they moved slowly off across the grass. "Did you understand what I mouthed at you back there?" asked Robin.
"That there was someone upstairs. Yeah," he said, wincing horribly every time he put down his false foot. "I did."
"You don't seem..."
"I'm not surprised." "Wait," he said abruptly, still leaning on her as he came to a halt. "You didn't go up there?"
"Yes," said Robin.
"For fuck's sake.
I heard footsteps.
And what would have happened if you'd been jumped?"
"I took a weapon and I wasn't. And if I hadn't gone up there, I wouldn't have seen this." Taking out her mobile, Robin brought up the photo of the painting on the bed and handed it to him. "You didn't see Kinvara's expression when she saw the blank wall. Cormoran... She didn't realize that painting had been moved until you asked about it. Whoever was upstairs tried to hide it while she was outside." Strike stared at the phone screen for what felt like a long time, his arm heavy on Robin's shoulders. Finally he said,
"Is that a piebald?"
"Seriously," said Robin in total disbelief. "Horse colours? Now?"
"Answer me."
"No. Piebalds are black and white, not brown and..."
"We need to go to the police," said Strike. "The odds on another murder just went up exponentially."
"You aren't serious?"
"I'm completely serious. Get me back to the car and I'll tell you everything. But don't ask me to talk till then, because my leg's fucking killing me."
Chapter 68 I Have Tasted Blood Now. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. 3 days later, Strike and Robin received an unprecedented invitation. As a courtesy for having chosen to aid, rather than upstage the police, in passing on information about Flick's stolen note and Mare Morning,
The Met welcomed the detective partners into the heart of the investigation at New Scotland Yard. Used to being treated by the police as either inconveniences or showboaters, Strike and Robin were surprised but grateful for this unforeseen thawing of relations. On arrival, the tall blonde Scot who was heading the team ducked out of an interrogation room for a minute to shake hands. Strike and Robin knew that the police had brought two suspects in for questioning, although nobody had yet been charged.
"We spent the morning on hysterics and flat denial," DCI Judy McMurran told them, "but I think we'll have cracked her by the end of the day." "Any chance we could give him a little look, Judy?" asked our subordinate, D.I. George Laybourne, who had met Strike and Robin at the door and brought them upstairs. He was a pudgy man who reminded Robin of the traffic policeman who had thought he was such a card, back on the hard shoulder where she'd had her panic attack.
"Go on, then," said DCI McMurran, with a smile.
Laybourne led Strike and Robin around the corner and through the first door on their right into a dark and cramped area, of which half one wall was a two-way mirror into an interrogation room. Robin, who had only ever seen such spaces in films and on TV, was mesmerized. Kinvara Chisel was sitting on one side of a desk, beside a thin-lipped solicitor in a pinstripe suit. White-faced, devoid of makeup, wearing a pale grey silk blouse so creased she might have slept in it, Kinvara was weeping into a tissue. Opposite her sat another detective inspector in a far cheaper suit than the solicitor's. His expression was impassive. As they watched, DCI McMurran re-entered the room and took the vacant chair beside her colleague. After what felt like a very long time, but was probably only a minute, DCI McMurran spoke.
"Still nothing to say about your night at the hotel, Mrs. Chisel."
"This is like a nightmare," whispered Kinvara. "I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe I'm here."
Her eyes were pink, swollen, and apparently lashless, now that she had wept her mascara away.
"Jasper killed himself," she said tremulously. "He was depressed. Everyone will tell you so. The blackmail was eating away at him. Have you talked to the Foreign Office yet? Even the idea that there might be photographs of that boy who was hanged. Can't you see how scared Jasper was? If that had come out..."
Her voice cracked.
"Where's your evidence against me?" she demanded. "Where is it? Where?"
Her solicitor gave a dry little cough.
"To return," said DCI McMurran, "to the subject of the hotel. Why do you think your husband called them, trying to ascertain—"
"It isn't a crime to go to a hotel,"
said Kinvara hysterically, and she turned to her solicitor.
"This is ridiculous, Charles. How can they make a case against me because I went to a—"
"Mrs. Chisel will answer any questions you've got about her birthday," the solicitor told DCI McMurran, with what Robin thought was remarkable optimism. But equally, the door of the observation room opened and hit Strike.
"No problem, we'll shift," Laybourne told his colleague. "Come on, gang, we'll go at the incident room. Got plenty more to show you."
As they turned a second corner, they saw Eric Wardle walking towards them.
"Never thought I'd see the day," he said, grinning as he shook Strike's hand. "Actually invited in by the Met."
"You staying, Wardle?" asked Laybourne, who seemed faintly resentful at the prospect of another policeman sharing the guests he was keen to impress.
"Might as well," said Wardle. "Find out what I've been assisting in all these weeks."
"Must have taken its toll," said Strike, as they followed Laybourne into the incident room. "Passing on all that evidence we found."
Wardle sniggered. Used as she was to the cramped and slightly dilapidated offices in Denmark Street, Robin was fascinated to see the space that Scotland Yard devoted to the investigation into a high-profile and suspicious death. A whiteboard on the wall carried a timeline for the killing. The adjacent wall bore a collage of photographs of the death scene and the corpse, the latter showing Chisel freed from his plastic wrapping so that his congested face appeared in awful close-up, with a livid scratch down one cheek, the cloudy eyes half open, the skin a dark, mottled purple. Spotting her interest, Laybourne showed her the toxicology reports and phone records that the police had used to build their case, then unlocked the large cupboard where physical evidence was bagged and tagged,
including the cracked tube of Lachesis pills, a grubby orange juice carton, and Kinvara's farewell letter to her husband. Seeing the note that Flick had stolen, and a printout of the photograph of Mare Morning, lying on a spare bed, both of which Robin knew had now become central to the police case, she experienced a rush of pride.
"Right then," said D.I. Leybourne, closing the cupboard and walking over to a computer monitor. "Time to see the little lady in action."
He inserted a video disc in the nearest machine, beckoning Strike, Robin and Wardle closer. The crowded forecourt of Paddington Station was revealed, jerky black-and-white figures moving everywhere. The time and date showed in the upper left corner.
"There she is," said Leybourne, hitting pause and pointing a stubby finger at a woman. "See her?"
Even though blurred, the figure was recognizable as Kinvara. A bearded man had been caught in the frame, staring, probably because her coat hung open, revealing the clinging black dress she had worn to the Paralympian reception. Leybourne pressed play again.
"Watch her, watch her. Gives to the homeless."
Kinvara had donated to a swaddled man holding a cup in a doorway.
"Watch her," Leybourne said unnecessarily. "Straight up to the railway worker. Pointless question, shows him a ticket. Watch her, now. Off to the platform, stops and asks another bloke a question, making sure she's remembered every bloody step of the way, even if she's not caught on camera. And onto the train."
The picture twitched and changed. A train was pulling into the station at Swindon. Kinvara got off, talking to another woman.
"See," said Leybourne, "still making damn sure people remember her just in case. And..."
The picture changed again, to that of the car park at Swindon Station.
"There she is," said Leybourne. "Cars parked right near the camera, conveniently. In she gets and off she goes. Gets home, insists the stable girl stays overnight, sleeps in the next room, goes outside next morning to ride within sight of the girl. Cast iron alibi.
Course, like you, we'd already come to the conclusion that if it was murder, it must have been a two-person job."
"Because of the orange juice?" asked Robin.
"Mostly," said Leybourne. "If Chiswell," he said the name as it was spelled, "had taken amitriptyline unknowingly, the most likely explanation was that he'd poured himself doctored juice out of a carton in a fridge, but the carton in the bin was undoctored and only had his prints on."
"Easy to get his prints on small objects once he was dead, though," said Strike. "Just press his hand onto them."
"Exactly," said Leybourne, striding over to the wall of photographs and pointing at a close-up of the pestle and mortar. "So we went back to this. The way Chiswell's prints are positioned, and the way the powdered residue was sitting there, pointed to it being faked, which meant the doctored juice could have been fixed up hours in advance by somebody who had a key, who knew which antidepressants the wife was on, that Chisel's sense of taste and smell were impaired, and that he always drank juice in the mornings. Then all they'd need to do is have the accomplice plant an undoctored juice carton in the bin with his dead handprint on, and take away the one with the amitriptyline residue in it.
Well, who's better positioned to know and do all of that than the missus?"
asked Leybourne rhetorically.
"But here she was, with a cast-iron alibi for time of death 70-odd miles away when he was gulping down antidepressants. Not to mention she's left that letter, trying to give us a nice clean story. Husband already facing bankruptcy and blackmail, realizes his wife's leaving him, which tips him over the edge, so he tops himself."
"But," said Leybourne, pointing at the enlarged picture of the dead Chisel's face, stripped of its plastic bag, revealing a deep red scrape on the cheek.
"We didn't like the look of that. We thought from the first that was suspicious. Amitriptyline in overdose can cause agitation as well as sleepiness. That mark looked as though somebody else forced the bag over his head. Then there was the open door. The last person in or out didn't know there was a trick to closing it properly, so it didn't look like Chiswell was the last person to touch it. Plus, the packaging on the pills being absent, that smelled wrong from the start. Why would Jasper Chiswell get rid of it?" asked Leybourne. "Just a few little careless mistakes."
"It nearly came off," said Strike.
"If only Chisel had been put to sleep by the amitriptyline as intended,
and if they'd thought the thing through right to the finest detail, close the door properly, leave the pill packaging in situ, but they didn't, said Leybourne. And she's not smart enough on her own to talk herself out of this. I can't believe this is happening, Strike quoted. She's consistent. On Saturday night she told us, I didn't think this would happen. It didn't seem real.
Try that in court, said Wardle quietly.
Yeah, what were you expecting, love, when you crushed up a load of pills and put them in his orange juice? Said Leybourne. Guilty is as guilty does. Amazing the lies people can tell themselves when they're drifting alone in the wake of a stronger personality, said Strike. I'll bet you a tenner that when McMurrin finally breaks her, Kinbara'll say they started off hoping Chisel would kill himself, then trying to pressure him into doing it, and finally reached a point where there didn't seem much difference between trying to push him into suicide and putting the pills in his orange juice herself. I notice she's still trying to push the gallows business as the reason he'd top himself.
That was very good work of yours, connecting the dots on the gallows, admitted Leybourne. We were a bit behind you on that, but it explained a hell of a lot.
This is highly confidential, he added, taking a brown envelope off a nearby desk and tipping out a large photograph. But we had this from the Foreign Office this morning. As you can see... Robin, who had gone to look, half wished she hadn't. What was there to be gained, really, from seeing the corpse of what seemed to be a teenage boy, whose eyes had been picked out by carrion birds and hanging from a gallows in a rubble-strewn street? The boy's dangling feet were bare. Somebody, Robin guessed, had stolen his trainers. The lorry containing the second pair of gallows was hijacked. Government never took delivery, and Chiswell never got payment for them. This picture suggests they ended up being used by rebels for extrajudicial killings. This poor lad, Samuel Marape, was in the wrong place at the wrong time. British student, gap year, out there to visit family. It's not particularly clear, Leybourne said. But see there, just behind his foot.
Yeah. That could be the mark of the white horse, said Strike.
Robin's mobile, which was switched to silent, vibrated in her pocket. She was waiting for an important call, but it was only a text from an unknown number. I know you've blocked my phone, but I need to meet you. An urgent situation's come up, and it's to your advantage as much as mine to sort it out, Matt.
It's nothing, Robin told Strike, returning the mobile to her pocket. This was the third message Matthew had left that day. Urgent situation, my ass.
Tom had probably found out that his fiancée and his good friend had been sleeping together. Maybe Tom was threatening to call Robin, or drop in on the office in Denmark Street, to find out how much she knew. If Matthew thought that constituted an urgent situation to Robin, who was currently standing beside multiple pictures of a drugged and suffocated government minister, he was wrong. With an effort, she refocused on the conversation in the incident room.
The necklace business, Leybourne was saying to Strike. Far more convincing story than the one he told us. All that guff about wanting to stop her hurting herself. It was Robin who got him to change his story, not me, said Strike.
Ah, well, good work, Leybourne said to Robin, with a hint of patronage. I thought he was an oily little bastard when I took his initial statement. Cocky, just out of jail and all. No bloody remorse for running over that poor woman.
How are you getting on with Francesca? Strike asked. The girl from the gallery.
We managed to get hold of the father in Sri Lanka, and he's not happy. Being quite obstructive, actually, said Leybourne. He's trying to buy time to get her lawyered up. Bloody inconvenient, the whole family being abroad. I had to get tough with him over the phone. I can understand why he doesn't want it all coming out in court, but too bad. Gives you a real insight into the mindset of the upper classes, eh? Case like this. One rule for them.
On that subject, said Strike, I assume you've spoken to Amir Malik.
Yeah, we found him exactly where your boy, Hutchins is it, said he was, at his sister's. He's got a new job.
Oh, I'm glad, said Robin inadvertently.
And he wasn't overjoyed to have us turn it up at first.
but he ended up being very frank and helpful. Said he found that disturbed lad, Billy is it, on the street, wanting to see his boss, shouting about a dead